Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, August 25th. I'm Jordan Pangelinan, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, California State Senate passes new Senate resolution to investigate the state's crude oil business. And Mendocino Land Trust conserves two parcels in Mendocino County, protecting vital habitats. So stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region. In a unanimous 38-0 vote, the California State Senate has passed Senate Resolution 51, calling for a full investigation into the state's reliance on crude oil extracted from the Amazon rainforest. Introduced by Senator Josh Becker, the resolution urges California to end its imports of Amazonian oil, a move spurred by years of advocacy and recently reinforced by a high-level indigenous delegation from Ecuador's Amazon, who visited the state to highlight the environmental and human impacts of oil extraction.
Senate Resolution 51 by Senator Becker relative to protecting the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador.
Senator Becker.
Thank you, Madam President. I'm proud to present SR 51, which does three things. Number one, it commends the work of indigenous leaders, some of whom joined us right here on the Senate floor just a few months ago, and their communities for their steadfast work in protecting the Amazon biome and safeguarding the future for their children and for their and for our entire planet. Second, it commits the Senate to investigate the impact of California's role in the consumption of crude sourced from the Amazon region. And third, commits the Senate to exploring ways that changes to state policies and practices can assist with efforts to preserve and protect the Amazon rainforest. Colleagues, protecting the Amazon is not just good for the communities that live there, but our climate here in California. California is dependent on the Amazon for temperature and rainfall regulation. In other words, our fates are linked.
Paul Paz y Niño, the deputy director for Amazon Watch, a nonprofit that has been a huge help in the passing of this bill. Since 1960, Amazon Watch has worked in direct partnership with the indigenous communities across the Amazon basin. This helps support their fight against industrial expansion, extraction, and human rights violations, and more. Paz y Niño explains more about how Amazon Watch links with recently passed SR 51.
So Amazon Watch has a campaign called End Amazon Crude. We've been working in the Western Amazon for many years with communities that have been resisting extraction. In fact, we've helped successfully beat off attempts from many different oil companies to drill for oil in the Amazon. However, oil is still drilled there. And the majority of that oil, especially from Ecuador, unfortunately ends up in California. And California has been refining that oil. Some of it is used in state. Some of it is shipped out of state. SR 51 is a California state resolution introduced by Josh Becker, and it is asking the state to examine the ways that it can help reduce and end this importation of this crude, because crude from the Amazon comes with human rights violations. It is additionally destructive to the climate because it threatens one of the most important biomes in fighting climate change. And it is violating indigenous rights every step of the way. And California, as a top destination, wants to avoid being a part of that those human rights violations and that climate destruction. So it's a critical piece in a step towards ending the importation of Amazonian crude to California.
Senator Becker has more on the stats for California's distribution.
And I'm going to share a shocking stat. 50% of the oil exported from the Amazon ends up in California refineries. However, I do want to note that not all that oil is used in California. Approximately 12% of the refined California product, over 200,000 barrels a day, is exported in the form of both gasoline and aviation fuel to Nevada and Arizona. About 60,000 is exported to global markets. So in short, the amount of petroleum product exported to other states as a percentage of overall imports to California is a good indicator that reducing California's reliance on crude oil from the Amazon will not restrict necessary supplies for in-state products. I'm sure we will hear about in-state production from my good colleague here in a moment. But as we navigate this transition period, we call it mid-transition, as the California Energy Commission has called it, the mid-transition period, we must continue ways we can ramp down demand as we continue our clean transportation leadership, as well as manage the decline of extraction in a way that prioritizes the needs of our most vulnerable communities, both here in California and abroad.
The vote on SR 51 comes on the heels of new plans in Ecuador and Peru to greatly expand Amazon oil drilling and a new source of future crude following to California. Ecuador announced its plan to offer new oil and gas bidding rounds, including the Ronda Sur Oriente, which would put 7 oil concessions of remote roadless rainforest and indigenous territories up for auction without their consultation or consent.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, Amazon Watch works in solidarity and partnership. Earlier this year, we brought 3 indigenous leaders from representing different parts of the Ecuadorian Amazon to California to meet with the California State Senate. And they had multiple meetings in offices. They also were brought down and honored on the floor of the California Senate. That's when this resolution was introduced. And it was at the behest of indigenous communities who are fighting a legacy of oil destruction. Chevron intentionally dumped billions of gallons of toxic waste into the Ecuadorian Amazon. The Yasuni National Park, which is the most biodiverse part of the Amazon, is being drilled now, in contrast to a resolution voted on twice by the people of Ecuador to end oil drilling. The government is not respecting that. And furthermore, the government of Ecuador is intending to open up 7 new areas of the southern Ecuadorian Amazon, as of yet pristine parts of the Amazon that have not been drilled for oil. It wants to expand to drill more oil. So these 3 indigenous leaders brought that message to California, asking for its government, its population, to help prevent further destruction and bring accountability for the destruction that's lasting, that especially what Chevron did and what's happening in Yasuni to this day. 2 years, it's been almost 2 years exactly since the Ecuadorian people voted to stop oil drilling in Yasuni, and yet the government has failed to comply with that.
Senator Becker addresses the recent approval of the 7 new oil concessions. Becker expresses concern over their implication and urges an immediate halt to crude oil imports.
I just want to wrap up to say I'm proud to have welcomed these 3 leaders and that 15 well-respected advocacy groups have signed on to this resolution. On August 19th, despite the will of the people, despite a resolution that was successful in Ecuador, on August 19th, the government announced 7 new oil blocks on titled indigenous land. And as we speak, the leaders of presidents of 7 indigenous nations are meeting right now to decide their strategy. So I feel this resolution, I know they're looking at this resolution, they're grateful for this resolution, and we hope this is a small but important step towards addressing the concerns of communities in the Amazon and aligns our work to transition off of fossil fuels here in California. I respectfully urge an aye vote.
Bas Imino also worked to dispel misconceptions about the fossil fuel industry, emphasizing that environmental activism is not to blame for the rising gas prices.
That's always the first thing, but this has been a trope used by the right and the fossil fuel industry day one. No matter what you say, if you want to protect families, if you want to protect the environment, if you want to save indigenous lives, like, oh, but you might drive up fuel prices. When the truth of the matter is the industry is increasing those prices for their profits. All you need to do is look at the annual profits of the fossil fuel industry, billions upon billions of dollars in profit. And it blows away the argument that, oh, this is going to drive up prices. They want that to be the story because that scares consumers and it stops us from protecting the environment. But ultimately, the fires that we have to cope with in California, the drought that we're experiencing, the drought that the Amazon is experiencing, these are all things that are going to affect people who are buying gas too. And if you don't have a home because it's been burned down, or you don't have food because the crops are so expensive due to droughts and fires, that's going to hit you too. And that's the story the fossil fuel industry doesn't want people to know. We have to really shine the light on the fact that this is about their profits over the survival of basically our entire climate and indigenous communities.
Bassimino emphasizes that the fight is far from over, noting that further action is needed to hold the government accountable. They highlight Governor Gavin Newsom's role and affirm that Amazon Watch will continue to push for his support in standing against the fossil fuel industry. For more information and steps to take action, Amazon Watch's website is amazonwatch.org. To take action, visit KMUD.org, or a Take Action tab will be listed on the Amazon Watch's website.
Secretary, please call the roll.
Allen. Aye. Alvarado Gill. Aye. Archuleta. Aye. Adegin. Aye. Ashby. Aye. Becker. Aye. Blakespear. Aye. Cabaldon. Aye. Caballero.
Two parcels of land in Mendocino County were recently placed in the stewardship of a trust fund, which may help two local endangered species survive, KMUD's Sigur Bjorn reports.
The Mendocino Land Trust recently added two easements to its stewardship of lands in Mendocino County. The first easement, donated by PG&E, is a 30-acre parcel adjacent to Point Arena on the Mendocino coast. The property, called Windy Hollow, has several protected plants on it and special wildlife habitats, according to a press release from the Land Trust. An easement agreement does not transfer ownership of a property, but rather places it into protective custody, so to speak, meaning the land cannot be developed. The PG&E land is home to the federally endangered Point Arena mountain beaver and potential habitat for Barron's silverspot butterfly, whose existence is also threatened. Both species have extremely limited range, confined to the Mendocino coast, and in the case of the beaver, just to Point Arena and the surrounding area. So being able to call this habitat a safe haven may be critical to the survival of the species. The second easement, recently bequeathed to the Land Trust, is a 2.3-acre property just east of Fort Bragg. The land, which has second-growth redwoods on it, was formerly owned by the late Sonia Popov, a ceramic artist who was a fixture in Fort Bragg life for decades. Thanks to the easement, these trees will now stand tall for generations to come, as future owners of the property will be prevented from harvesting them. The news of the two easements comes on the heels of the Mendocino Land Trust's purchase of a 157-acre blufftop property called Bell Point, which is close to Westport on the county's northern coast. The trust is currently preparing construction of trails along the oceanfront property, but ultimately plans to return it to Kai Poma, a non-profit representing three local native tribes. The Mendocino Land Trust remit is to conserve and restore habitat, scenic areas, and working lands, while also providing public access to them with the construction of trails and other access points. In its 40-year history, the non-profit has protected more than 40,000 acres in Mendocino, opened five preserves to the public, and completed over 17 miles of trails. I'm Sigur Bjørn, reporting for KMUD.
In state news, on Women's Equality Day, experts press for equity. From the Public News Service, Suzanne Potter reports.
Today is Women's Equality Day, honoring the day in 1920 that women got the right to vote. This year, advocates are speaking out on the quest for equity, not just equality. Experts say American women may have equal rights, but true equity would require equal outcomes on measures such as salary, leadership positions, and assets. Sonia Passy is CEO of Free From, a nonprofit that helps survivors of domestic violence and their families thrive.
I'm so glad that we've moved into an era where we talk about gender equity instead of gender equality, because it's not enough to just say, let's all be equal. And equity really gets at what it would take for us to get there.
To achieve financial gender equity, advocates say policymakers need to deliver on promises of affordable health care and child care. And they encourage companies to provide flexible work schedules so employees can balance work and caregiving responsibilities. Nurai Azbe works with the Self-Help Federal Credit Union, a community development financial institution that offers free financial coaching. She notes that since January, more than 200,000 women have left the workforce, and says a lot of it has to do with post-COVID return-to-office mandates, the rising cost of childcare, and the persistent wage gap.
Women in the U.S. earn 83 cents for every dollar a man earns. So it's not hard to understand why women sort of started to participate to the labor force less and less.
Advocates for women have identified what they call the four essential pillars of equity. They include economic access and mobility, freedom from violence, access to high-quality health care, and reproductive justice. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Democratic leaders blast Trump, sending troops to Democrat-run cities. KPFA's Sophia Rice-Elfany reports.
President Donald Trump said on Friday that Chicago is next on his list for a National Guard deployment, part of his broader attempts to crack down on violence in U.S. cities. Trump has repeatedly targeted Democratic-led cities, accusing them of being crime-ridden. He has already deployed the National Guard to Washington, D.C., and has floated the possibility of sending troops to Chicago, New York, Oakland, and San Francisco. Numerous U.S. cities are now pushing back against Trump's military deployments. On Monday, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker responded to Trump's threat at a news conference alongside Mayor Brandon Johnson of Chicago and other state officials. The officials criticized Trump's move as an overreach of power, saying there's no emergency in Chicago that warrants sending in the National Guard. They also argue he doesn't have the authority to do so without the state's approval. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker.
This is not about fighting crime. This is about Donald Trump searching for any justification to deploy the military in a blue city, in a blue state, to try and intimidate his political rivals.
Violent crime in Chicago dropped significantly in the first half of the year, representing the steepest decline in over a decade, according to city data. Shootings are down 37%, and homicides have dropped by 32%, while total violence crime dropped by over 22%. Governor Pritzker also raised the question of why Republican states and cities with higher crime rates than Chicago, like Memphis, Tennessee, or Hattiesburg, Mississippi, are not being targeted by the Trump administration. Illinois Democratic leaders say there's more to the federalization of the National Guard than just public safety concerns. Governor Pritzker continues.
We found out what Donald Trump was planning the same way that all of you did. We read a story in the Washington Post. If this was really about fighting crime and making the streets safe, what possible justification could the White House have for planning such an exceptional action without any conversations or consultations with the governor, the mayor, or the police?
The White House does not have the same authority over cities beyond Washington. When the president calls on troops without the governor's permission, the Guard is limited to protecting federal buildings and personnel, not domestic law enforcement. But Chicago Democratic leaders do not want that type of federal intervention. What they want is federal investment, according to Mayor Brandon Johnson.
Chicagoans are not calling for a military occupation. They are calling for the same thing that we've been calling for some time, and that's investment. What safe cities across America all have in common, they invest in people, and that's what we're doing in Chicago.
Mayor Johnson also called on the federal government to release the $800 million for violence prevention funds that were stripped away in April. At the news conference, many officials highlighted that the role of the National Guard is to fight in the battlefield, adding that the troops are not trained to arrest people and read them their Miranda rights. In Oakland, Mayor Barbara Lee has also dismissed Trump's earlier threats, pointing to data that shows violent crime trending down. Mayor Barbara Lee spoke at the Democratic National Convention summer meeting in Minneapolis on Monday.
Violent crime is down 29%. right? Homicides are down 21%. Vehicle thefts are down 45%. And yes, we have more work to do. Donald Trump is just downright wrong about Oakland, like he's wrong about all the other cities that he trashed.
Several Democratic officials are pushing legislation to block potential federal takeovers of local law enforcement, setting the stage for this conflict to dominate U.S. political discourse in the months ahead. This is Sophia Rais Alfeni for Pacifica Evening News, KPFA.
In national news, Trump issues executive order to create National Guard units to quell unrest and cash bail and send flag burners to jail. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
President Donald Trump has a bit of a penchant for governing by executive order, and on Monday, he signed another batch of orders with his big, beautiful Sharpie.
There's no auto pen that can do that. Right? Look at that, Pam. Is that a good signature? Seriously, is that a good signature? Who can write like that? Nobody.
One order targets flag burning. It directs the Department of Justice to investigate flag burning incidents and to prosecute the flag burners. Trump says flag burning incites riots and, in his words, people go crazy.
And what the penalty is going to be, if you burn a flag, you get 1 year in jail. No early exits, no nothing. You get 1 year in jail. If you burn a flag, you get. And what it does is incite to riot. I hope they use that language, by the way. Did they?
Yeah, incitement.
Incite to riot. And you burn a flag, you get 1 year in jail. You don't get 10 years. You don't get 1 month. You get 1 year in jail, and it goes on your record. And you will see flag burning stopping immediately.
Critics, including civil liberties advocates, question the legality of Trump's move, saying it conflicts with First Amendment rights. The order contradicts a 1989 Supreme Court ruling that protects flag burning as political expression. The executive order instructs the Attorney General to challenge the 1989 ruling. Two other orders aim at ending cashless bail. Opponents of cash bail describe it as a penalty on poverty, suggesting that the wealthy can pay their way out of jail to await trial, while those with fewer financial resources have to sit it out behind bars. Trump disagrees.
Somebody kills somebody, they go in, don't worry about it, no cash, come back in a couple of months, we'll give you a trial. You never see the person again. And, I mean, they kill people and they get out. Cashless bail.
One order ends cashless bail specifically in the District of Columbia, meaning people who are arrested there will be kept pre-trial in federal jail. The other order directs the Attorney General to identify jurisdictions around the country that have cashless bail and revoke their federal funds. And then there's a fourth executive order. It directs the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, to establish specially trained and equipped National Guard rapid response units to quell civil disturbances in cities. That order seems to suggest Trump means to expand the military role in law enforcement nationwide, and especially in cities run by Democratic mayors. Vice President J.D. Vance praised Trump's action.
Look at Governor Pritzker in Illinois, or Governor Newsom in Los Angeles, or Governor Moore in Maryland. They are angrier about the fact that the President of the United States is offering to help them get their crime under control than they are about the fact that murderers are running roughshod over their cities and have been for decades. Why are Democrat governors angrier about federal law enforcement helping clean up their streets than they are about the fact that those streets need to be cleaned up to begin with? It shows a real sickness in the head.
Trump's use of the military in U.S. cities has sparked outrage among many, including Democratic governors like Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker. But Trump dismissed Pritzker as a slob, calling Illinois a killing field.
And they say, we don't need him. Freedom, freedom. He's a dictator. He's a dictator. A lot of people are saying, maybe we like a dictator. I don't like a dictator. I'm not a dictator. I'm a man with great common sense and I'm a smart person.
Democratic Congressperson Jared Moskowitz of Florida's response, he's tougher on Chicago than he is on dealing with Putin, so maybe just take that attitude. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In national Native news, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is national Native news. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In what the South Dakota Attorney General calls the end of a three-decade legal saga, courts have upheld the extradition of John Graham, Graham was convicted of the 1975 murder of Annie Mae Aquash. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's C.J. Keene has more.
Annie Mae Aquash was an American Indian Movement activist whose long unsolved kidnapping, rape, and murder shocked South Dakota and the nation in the mid-1970s. Her body was discovered in a rural area near Wan Blee with a gunshot wound which traveled up from the hairline through the head. State Attorney General Marty Jackley describes the crime as an execution and says he's confident in the result of the trial. As a former United States Attorney for South Dakota, Jackley has long been involved in the case.
Ultimately, Graham took issue with the Canadian extradition, and today, ultimately, the Canadian Ministry of Justice has affirmed and reconsented to the extradition. And so John Graham will remain convicted of the execution of Annie Mae Aquash and shall continue to serve his life imprisonment without the chance of parole.
Graham, a Canadian national, was arrested for the murder in 2003. He's now 70 years old. Jackley says he believes this bookends the legal saga.
I feel realistically this is the end of the road. This is the Canadian Ministry of Justice. This is the appellate stage. So absent a governor's pardon, I feel that John Graham is where he needs to be.
Prior appeals from Graham's team have gone to the state Supreme Court, federal courts, and now through the Canadian extradition process. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
John Graham will remain in South Dakota state custody. A federal trial began Monday in Anchorage for a class action lawsuit against the Alaska Office of Children's Services, or OCS. The lawsuit is on behalf of all children in OCS custody, which includes Alaska Natives and American Indians. Marsha Lowry is an attorney and director of a national nonprofit advocating for foster care reforms. She says they're helping with the lawsuit because Alaska's foster system has some of the worst outcomes in the country.
They have a very, very high maltreatment rate. They do not have the kids visited every month. That's a federal requirement. Children have to be visited because how else can you know whether a child is safe when you put a child in a foster home?
The complaint alleges OCS caseworkers have too many cases to be able to adequately serve families. It also alleges the agency has failed to place Alaska Native foster children in culturally appropriate placements, violating the Indian Child Welfare Act. OCS Director Kim Guay also took the stand. She said all OCS employees are working to make positive changes in the system and that the agency has taken steps to increase recruitment and improve training, and repeatedly said that OCS is only one piece of the child welfare system. Margaret Peyton Walsh is Assistant Attorney General for the state and defending OCS in the trial. She says running the foster care system in Alaska is challenging.
It's especially hard in Alaska because of the size and the remoteness of so many of the communities, and we are doing the best that we can to manage the challenges that we have. And there are definitely challenges. Nobody is denying that. And I think critically in this context, we have a very, very severe caseworker shortage.
The trial is expected to take 3 weeks. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Sior Bjorn, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, Sophia Rice-Elfany, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@KMUD.org. Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Jordan Pangelinan.